Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today for what is the final Three Martini Lunch podcast for the week. We'll be off on Good Friday. We have good and bad and crazy martinis today. We start with the good, and it was a very mixed night. Ian, on Tuesday, there were two states voting for the Republican nomination for president. Arizona overwhelmingly going for Donald Trump. He got all 58 of their delegates. Utah was having its caucus. There was no guarantee of winner take all, but Ted Cruz, if he cleared 50%, was going to get all 40 Utah delegates. He ended up getting almost 70% of the vote in those caucuses. So Cruz takes all 40, and he's claiming momentum as a result of that, even though each of them won a state. But he's also potentially got a little bit of a shot in the arm here from a new Emerson College poll based on the next major contest, and that's in Wisconsin come April 5th. In the latest survey, Ted Cruz is leading Donald Trump 36-35%. So essentially, it's a dead heat. John Kasich trails them somewhat substantially. But there's more. Cruz is not only leading Trump within the margin of error, but he's only 1 point behind Hillary Clinton in a hypothetical matchup in Wisconsin, 46-45%. In contrast, the survey says Trump is trailing both Clinton and Bernie Sanders by the same 9-point margin of 47-38 in a potential general election matchup. We're also seeing a Bloomberg poll out that shows that Trump matching up poorly against Hillary Clinton, and Fox is saying the same thing. So good news in Wisconsin, especially considering that's the next critical race in this campaign.
We keep looking at these firebreak states. It's hard to think of a race that doesn't break well for Trump if he were to manage to pull off Wisconsin. You look at this Emerson College poll, one of the things that's interesting is his favorability is absolutely underwater. It's 25-69, if memory serves. So you have just a really fantastic opportunity for conservatives, a real conservative candidate, in this case Cruz, to come out and pull the state out from under Trump and give himself a real boost. Why is that important? Well, it's important in part because Wisconsin is an important general election state. This is a state that Donald Trump is going to have just a miserable time winning. And, his path to the presidency, God forbid, would have to theoretically go through these states that are, white working class purple states, where people are feeling disenfranchised, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, this type of demographic. If Trump is only edging out a candidate or losing in a primary, then if he's the nominee, he's just going to get crushed in this state, which squares with all of the evidence and everything that we've been, we over here at NR and other people have been trying to, beat Trump fans over the head with for the past 2 months, which is that he's probably going to get crushed by Hillary Clinton regardless. But strictly from a pragmatic standpoint, if you want a Republican in the White House, you're much better off if Cruz were to win Wisconsin, ideally, win Pennsylvania along with it, and get the nominee at a broker convention, which is the most likely alternative scenario at this point, than to have Trump sweep all these states in the primary and then lose in a catastrophe in November. I mean, set aside all the questions of, principles and policies and the rest, but if you want the R next to the guy's name, this is a race that is going to be important and instructive.
If we're going to use that argument, though, Ian, what about Kasich? He seems to be polling the best in a lot of these different surveys, whether it's against Clinton or Sanders, and he only needs 120% of the delegates outstanding to clinch the nomination.
That's quite right.
But does this give him an excuse to stay in the race longer than people who would like to clear the field would appreciate?
I'm not sure Wisconsin does, but Pennsylvania does. A new poll out, I think, has Kasich within 3 points of Trump in Pennsylvania. I don't know how reliable that poll is. But yeah, there's certainly some logic to that. The problem is Kasich has as good a chance of actually coming out on top in a brokered convention, O.J. Simpson at this point. I mean, there's just you pick who you want. I was discussing this with a colleague the other day. It's simply an unfathomable scenario to me in which 1,237 delegates look at all three candidates as well as look at all of the every eligible Republican who they could pull in and say, no, we're going to go with John Kasich. You know, I think they would pluck someone who's not even in the race onto the convention floor before they would go to John Kasich. There are just so many behind the scenes things that militate against him. Your point's well taken on the polls. And of course, that's part of the Kasich campaign's argument is, look, Cruz isn't going to win these states. So if we stay in, either we'll be the ones who help Republicans actually get to a broker convention. You know, whether that's true or not, I think it's a dubious argument, but I take your point.
Yeah, it's the best argument he's got left. I think we could agree on. All right, on to a double-barreled bad martini now, and we'll take these separately, actually. This issue of the president's trip to Cuba has taken on so many negative dimensions that we've covered in depth this week, and one that we really haven't touched on a lot is the fate of Guantanamo Bay, both the president's immediate plans to empty out the place and transfer anybody who's still left there to facilities in the United States, and then there's also growing rumors about the president potentially being willing to give the whole facility back to the Cubans. He hasn't said anything about that in specific, but there was a hearing up on Capitol Hill, and Paul Lewis, who is the Defense Department Special Envoy for Guantanamo Detention, was speaking before the House Foreign Relations Committee and was being grilled by one of the senior members, Dana Rohrabacher of California. And here's what Rohrabacher wanted to know, and let's just say he wasn't very happy or satisfied with the response.
How many lives have been lost by those terrorists who went back to their terrorist activity? How many lives?
I can talk about that in a classified setting, but
Classified?
Yes.
So is it over 10?
Sir, what I can tell you is, unfortunately, there have been Americans that have died because of Gitmo detainees.
How many Americans have to die? How many people in Brussels or Paris have to die, civilians? What's the threshold at that point? Well, maybe we will keep them under control in Gitmo.
Sir, when anybody dies, it's a tragedy, and we don't want anybody to die because we transfer detainees. However, it's the best judgment and the considered judgment of this administration and the previous administration that the risk of keeping Gitmo open is outweighed, that we should close Gitmo.
Ian, I don't have hard facts on this, but the argument from the left, of course, has been that Gitmo being open is a recruiting tool for the terrorists. Is there any evidence to back that up as far as you know?
Not that I know of. National Review wrote an editorial about this last month when the president sent his faux policy up to Capitol Hill. It doesn't square with common sense. Look, there were Islamic militants seeking to kill American citizens and Westerners long before Guantanamo Bay was open, and they're presumably going to want to continue killing American citizens and Westerners in general long after Guantanamo Bay is closed. I mean, here's the thing. Steve Hayes of the Weekly Standard has done fantastic reporting on this. He's sort of been dogged on this point. There were 800 detainees at Guantanamo at its peak. There are 91 left, and I think there are 35, 36 who are cleared for transfer. They just have to make sure that the countries that they're transferring them to approve the arrangement. So, we're down to 60 actual hard detainees left that we don't know what to do with, and that's why Obama, wants to either get rid of them or bring them onto American soil, which is bad for a whole lot of other reasons, and we can talk about those. But Steve Hayes pointed out last February, Brian McKeon, who was principal deputy undersecretary at the Department of Defense, noted that 17% of all released Gitmo detainees are known to have rejoined the fight, and another 12.5% are suspected of doing so. So one in three Guantanamo detainees are almost certainly returned and are trying to kill American citizens. I don't know what fantasy world this president exists in where the considered judgment is that releasing these last 90, 30 of whom will apparently go back to the fight based on these statistics, is somehow a better outcome than keeping them holed up in Guantanamo where, they're not hurting anyone. For the president, I think there's this fake pragmatic judgment that, it is a recruitment tool for terrorism, again, which I've seen no evidence to support. But then there's just this woolly moral notion that, you know, the president's speech when he announced his plan last month was, this is closing a chapter of history and opening a chapter of, you know, miserable history for everyone who's going to become victims of these people when they rejoin the fight in Yemen and Syria and North Africa and, you know, all these other places. This is the same type of moral posturing that, you know, this president has taken up when it comes to waterboarding, when it comes to a whole lot of other policies related to actually taking the fight to terrorists or making sure that, in this case, the extraordinary situation of making sure that the actual terrorists we have captured, you know, stay captured.
The president, after his trip to Cuba, went to Argentina. He was at a press conference there with the new Argentinian leader. And the president got asked a question by one of the reporters about whether the U.S. would be stepping up our activities potentially in Syria as a result of ISIS not only attacking once again in Brussels, but promising to train hundreds of other people and sending them to Europe to carry out more attacks. Very quick bites here, but just try to ruminate on these a little bit and think about the context and the significance of what the president is saying here. First, this is what he said at the very beginning of his response.
I addressed this issue a little bit at the baseball game when I was interviewed by ESPN, but let me reiterate it.
Which basically is saying, once again, reminding people he was at a baseball game in the wake of a terror attack and apparently seeming exasperated, Ian, that he had to act, that he actually had to answer the question again because he did it while he was in between episodes of The Wave. Here's what he said immediately after that.
Groups like ISIL can't destroy us. They can't defeat us. They don't produce anything. They're not an existential threat to us.
This is an issue that Jim Garrity always gets fired up about because he basically sees the president come to the conclusion that ISIS doesn't have the capability to literally bring down the very pillars of our republic. So therefore, everybody just calm down a little bit.
Yeah, the Nazi Party wasn't an existential threat in 1933. It's sort of perfectly illustrative of this president's foreign policy approach to all foreign policy, all threats, which is as long as it's not absolutely imminent, you know, as long as Russia is not literally, you know, firing missiles at us, as long as it's only annexing the people next door, you know, as long as Iran is only firing long range missiles that aren't equipped with nuclear warheads, you know, all is well. I mean, it's a truly astonishing lack of foresight. And then he adds the condescension of saying, well, I addressed this on America's number one sports network.
Let it into a tangent off into his brackets and how well he was doing after the first two rounds or how poorly. I don't know. I didn't see his brackets.
Maybe that's what's happening. You know, he had like ISIS and Boko Haram on one, you know, in his eastern bracket. And he's just waiting for that to sort of filter out, you know, on the other side, you've got Russia and China duking it out. And so maybe his whole foreign policy is an NCAA bracket slowly converging.
From that, let's move on to the crazy martini. And unfortunately, we've got a follow up to yesterday's bad martini. Yesterday, we talked about the Super PAC, not affiliated at all with Ted Cruz, putting out the ad in Utah with a racy photo of Melania Trump saying, do you really want this to be your next First Lady? Trump blamed Cruz for it, and Cruz said he had nothing to do with this. Then Trump put out a tweet saying, we're going to spill the beans on your wife. Cruz referred to Trump in a tweet as a coward. Trump has now retweeted something on Twitter where somebody said a picture is worth 1,000 words, and there's a glamorous model picture of Melania with an unflattering picture of Heidi Cruz. And all of this leading to Ted Cruz going on CNN with the Chris Cuomo and defending his wife, obviously, but also referencing a movie line.
When Donald gets scared, when he gets angry, when he's threatened, he begins yelling, he begins screaming, he begins often cursing, and he begins trying to be a bully. So last night, Donald threatened my wife. He went directly after my wife. And I got to tell you that, number one, Heidi, my wife, she's the daughter of missionaries in Africa. She is my best friend in the world. And if Donald wants to get in a character fight, he's better off sticking with me because Heidi is way out of his league.
And that last line was from a movie called The American President back in the 90s starring Michael Douglas.
You want a character to debate, Bob? You better stick with me because Sidney Ellen Wade is way out of your league.
So we know Cruz loves movies. He quotes The Princess Bride and others all the time. And Ian, it's interesting that while Cruz is being attacked now from Trump and others for stealing from Michael Douglas, that's now getting the media's attention rather than the fact that Trump personally keeps going after Heidi Cruz.
We talked the other day about Sarah Palin and the entertainment culture that we now have that pervades and directs our political culture. And this is another example. Right? I mean, I suspect Cruz wasn't trying to pull one over on anyone by quoting that line. But now the obvious impulse is to think about our inclination toward entertainment and politics, the fact that we all indulge it in the form of, you know, Trump, and then play pious and sanctimonious by jumping on Cruz on this point, which, you know, is just the blatant sort of dishonesty or lack of self-awareness, whichever you like, of the media. As for Trump, this is perfectly in character. I wrote a little bit about this yesterday. You know, Cruz is exactly right. You know, Trump is a bully. This happened because he lost Utah on Tuesday, and he's a sore loser. And the way that sore losers deal with losing is by lashing out and projecting their loss on someone weaker than themselves. So he projected his loss onto, you know, Heidi Cruz, and he beat her up as a way to make himself feel better. That's who Donald Trump is. He's a guy who, to buck himself up, bullies women over Twitter. What is truly astonishing to me is anyone who thinks that that's going to be a fruitful or constructive way of being in executive office. You know, is he going to get angry at, you know, the Chinese premier and tweet angrily at some women in his cabinet? I mean, what kind of woman, too, would want to be in Trump's cabinet if, as his retweet sort of implies, the most valuable thing about them or all you need to know about them, the only reason you should take them seriously is because they're attractive, which is effectively what he was communicating by retweeting this contrast between a Heidi Cruz picture and a Melania picture. What kind of self-respecting woman would want to subject herself to that if that's going to be his attitude in a cabinet meeting? I mean, you know, the flip side is maybe the United States will have the most classy, luxurious, beautiful cabinet that it's ever had. It may also have the most utterly incompetent, completely out of its depth cabinet if this is the way that Donald Trump values people.
Ian, you're forgetting, though. Ben Carson let us in on the secret a couple weeks ago. There's two Donald Trumps, and we've just never seen the other one, so it'll be totally, totally different if he's elected.
Oh, well, that's... I can wipe my brow in relief. All this, you know, I'm so glad that we're going to have this total black box get into the White House.
Ian, as we mentioned at the top, tomorrow is Good Friday. There will be no three martini lunch. Thank you so much for filling in for Jim while he was on spring break. Have a blessed Easter, and we'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Same to you. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. Have a blessed Easter, everyone. Join us Monday for the next Three Martini Lunch.